This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're on Saturday Magazine with Michael and Fiona. Thank you, Paul, for the news. Michael, who's our next guest?
Oh, we have a wonderful guest coming up. Who else but Zoe Daniel, independent MP for the seat of Goldstein in our federal parliament. Zoe, good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Very well. And before I hand over a commiseration, a fellow ex-ABC Victor employee, I should say. And I think we may have met on the tracks when we were both employed by Auntie. So lovely to talk to you this morning.
You too.
You've been involved in some wonderful campaigns lately, particularly one that is linking, and this sounds extraordinary, women's economic equality and its correlation with women's actual safety. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so gender equality is very central to my policy agenda. Of the pillars that I took to the 2022 election, gender equality was a really key one. So my team and I have been working on changing legislation in the parliament to put a gender lens over particularly legislation that relates to women's economic empowerment. Mm. So we've put gender equality into the object of the Fair Work Act, for example. We've put a gender lens over the Jobs and Skills Australia legislation, which will guide skill development policy in Australia in the forthcoming years. And also we've put a gender lens over the National Reconstruction Fund legislation, which means that venture capital would need to be considered for female-led businesses, and also the makeup of those businesses would need to be considered in terms of their gender leadership mix and also the gender pay equity factor. Yeah. My view very much is that we need to enable women and girls economically to give them choices, and that really underpins respect for women, which is where the connection to gender-based violence is. Until we have economic equality and empowerment, we won't solve the issues around violence against women. And also there is that very direct relationship between gender-based violence and lack of choice for women who can't leave a violent relationship because they're not financially.
Yeah, that's right. And that lack of choice stems directly from a lack of economic empowerment. It's such a no-brainer, isn't it? And so many women I know feel, well, you know you're in a bad situation, but you can't leave because you have no economic independence. Because one of the things that gets taken away from people in these sorts of relationships is economic independence, Zoe.
Yeah, well, obviously there are specific issues around financial coercive control, and that is a reality for many women in violent relationships. But there are also just the structural issues within our culture, within our economy, which mean that women, although we have among the most highly educated women in the world, the default position during childbearing years is that women will be, usually if it's a male-female partnership, the woman will stay home with the kids. Often that is because the woman earns less than the man, because we have that gender pay gap. And then once you've stayed home with the kids, you're behind because you don't get superannuation on your paid parental leave, you lose contact with the workforce, it might not be worth going back for a substantial number of hours because of the cost of care for the kids. And then it's very difficult for women to catch up. And that's one of the reasons that we have women over 55 as the highest growing group of homeless in the country, because if they then do leave a relationship later in life or lose their partner for some reason, then they're not able to stand on their own two feet financially.
Well, certainly the superannuation pay on maternity leave is an incredibly welcome and much, much, much overdue program. And I personally am very excited by that change. And also, as a woman over the age of 55, I certainly feel, and I have numbers of friends in the same boat, you know, we don't necessarily have partners, or even if you do have partners, there's no guarantees that you will, you know, those relationships will exist, or indeed your partner might pass away. And the fact is that it's very scary for myself. I mean, and numbers of my friends, we're right at that cusp of, you know, obviously having networks are helpful, but, you know, it's a very real fear. And certainly the any improvements that can be put in a place for the women of the younger generations, women that are coming up, more security, and why shouldn't they have greater sense of equality and a greater sense of safety? And if they want to bear children, you should not be penalised, because, you know, you're bringing forth the people that are going to pay for everyone's aged care, you know, as they get older.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, now Zoe, that brings us up to, of course, the marvellous news yesterday that the aged care workers received a 28% pay rise.
Yes. So that is certainly a big step forward for workers in aged care, but also the fact that we need more workers in aged care. So, you know, you have to actually pay people properly in order to encourage people to work in that sector. And the same would apply to staff in early childhood education and care. You know, given that we're talking about women's empowerment, I mean, that's one of the things that I'm working on in the lead up to the federal budget. So abolishing the activity test, which dictates how many hours you have to prove that you're working before you can get the childcare subsidy, but also enabling childcare workers by paying them more as well. So therefore encouraging people to work in that sector, and again, then opening up the option for more women to work because they're able to get care for their kids. But certainly from the aged care perspective, you know, there are so many structural problems in aged care, and one of them, and I do a lot of engagement with aged care providers in my electorate, is the inability to get staff. And you simply won't get staff until you pay them properly. And that's one of the structural issues in our economy too, that the fastest growing sector of the economy is the care sector.
Yes.
And it's a highly feminised sector, so the vast majority of the staff are women and they are chronically underpaid. So again, this circle goes round and round. So that is a step forward that the government has taken that I very much support.
I mean, we're talking, well, not just we or me, but Zoe, there's talk of like a tsunami. They're talking about a sort of social tsunami of aged care heading our way, because we are a rapidly aging population and we're going to need people to take care of them. And I'm wondering, is this a bit like the like climate change? Have governments been slow to realise that this is an impending problem?
Well, I think obviously the Aged Care Royal Commission really put a focus on this rightly in Australia, and the government through legislation, and obviously this has been coming across my desk a lot, has been gradually implementing the various recommendations of the Aged Care Royal Commission in terms of treatment of and care of people in aged care as it should. I think that the issue that we have, as you've rightly said already, is that we have an ageing society. We are going to end up in a situation where less people are working, supporting more people who are not working, and the burden will be on our younger people to fund care for older people. So that then creates this very thorny political question of, as you've seen this week, whether some degree of user pays should be introduced for people of higher wealth. And that's really, I think, the piece that's been thrown into the debate after the review of aged care, and that's a community conversation that we now have to begin to have to decide how we do that, what is palatable to the community, what people's expectations are of the kind of care that they should get as they get older, and indeed the fact that that need for care takes the burden off other family members. Who otherwise will be caring for their parents, their older parents.
Now, Zoe, if you would like to hold a few seconds, we're going to take a quick ad break, and then we will be back to continue this conversation. You're on Joy 94.9. It's Saturday morning. You're with Fiona and Michael and our guest, Zoe Daniel, independent MP for Goldstein. Zoe, I just wanted to ask you on that question. We were just discussing about the proposed payments for that people who have a little more resources, financial resources, to pay for their aged care, contribute to their aged care. What are people in your electorate saying about that? You've been talking to, no doubt, your constituents?
Yeah, so I think the response to it is varied, and I think in part that's because we really need to get some clear information out to people about what that might look like, because I think people's response to it is going to be dependent on, well, you know, how much and where does that money come from. And, for example, in certainly parts of my electorate, there are a lot of people who are in very high-value properties, but they might have fairly low cash flow if they're retired. So one of the questions that came up straight away this week, well, you know, what if my partner has to go into care, but I want to stay in the family home? I don't want to be forced to sell that property or remortgage the property for a mortgage that I can't afford to pay in order to top up the cost of my partner's care. Now, you know, this is a community debate that we need to have, a conversation, again, as I said, about what's palatable and what people think is appropriate. But getting back to a sort of gender balance issue, I know for a fact that there are a lot of older women in high-value properties in my electorate who have low cash flow and who struggle to maintain those properties, for example, but who don't move because stamp duty cost of changing property over is so high. So again, there's sort of structural barriers in the property market that are creating that. But you also wouldn't, I don't think you'd want to create a situation where women who often live longer than men have to sell the house because their partner has to go into care. So this is a kind of actually quite complicated and also interesting and worthwhile conversation to have, I think. So to enable people to understand what the steps might look like.
And also, you know, it is interesting because it seems to have bipartisan support, at least between the two parties, the two major parties, which you don't sort of often see. But I don't know, we've come election time, if this is still a topic of conversation, whether, you know, the opposition would be going for that or whether they would be using that as a, you know, as a weapon. It must be very interesting being an independent and on the crossbench, you know, working with the two major parties.
Yeah. Are you something of a celebrity amongst the amongst your fellow parliamentarians, Zoe? I reckon they kind of envy you. I've got this idea of people from Liberal Lab coming and saying, oh, gee, Zoe, you actually got it. You know, my party's giving me the ear at so much. I kind of envy you being an independent. Now, is there some truth in that?
Look, I think what I would say is that being an independent is very different to being a member of one of the major parties. And certainly, and look, I'm not a member of either of the major parties, so I don't really understand how stuff works in there. And also I think it's quite different depending which party you're in. Yeah, so, for example, you know, in the Liberal Party room or in the Labor caucus, the backbenchers get to put their views forward in that sort of group setting, and then they may or may not be then rolled into the policy or considered in terms of the way forward on whichever policy position the party is going to take. The beauty of being an independent is that obviously it's much more direct in that you have that interaction with community on something like these proposed changes to aged care, and you're then unencumbered by the party position. You can speak for your community or, you know, reflect the views of your community, but also considering the broader benefit for the country. So there's a sort of a lot less roadblocks in it. I do think that, you know, there is a lot of capacity to have influence, not only by the numbers, by having the balance of power, but also by actively participating in and elevating issues into the public conversation in a way that they wouldn't otherwise be, and also just simply by calling things as you see it and holding both the major parties to account, encouraging both of them to be more ambitious and more less political in the approach that they take to things.
The Zoe Daniel party room must be a very small... You could have your entire party room in a wardrobe, really, basically, couldn't you?
Oh, yes, although, what you realise when you get this sort of decision-making is that, you know, most decisions, not all, but most decisions involve some degree of compromise. You know, there are very few binary decisions where it's very simple to decide. A lot of these policy decisions are complicated. There are often going to be negative consequences for someone. And so you do really need to think through what is the best outcome for most people, and that's something that I take incredibly seriously, and my team and I take a lot of time making some of these complicated decisions on legislation and policy.
Now, Zoe, of course, there is increasing conversations about the increased number of independents and crossbenchers that we will see coming forth, and certainly for the next election. And it seems like this is an exciting time to be an independent, because you're part of the forward movement that we could possibly see in Australian politics, with the move away from the major parties and the potential for a greater collaboration. Are you seeing encouraging signs from, some other people coming up in the ranks to develop more on this idea of more independence in our politics?
So, short answer is, I don't really know. I know that, for example, the Community Independence Project, which it was really born out of INDI in the Cathy McGowan era, mm-hmm. is doing a lot of broad community work, consultation, education, and therefore enabling of communities. And they do a lot of Zoom events, for example, and they have hundreds of people on those events from communities right across the country. So what the Community Independence Project tries to do is to, you know, set a framework that community organisations can follow if they would like to try to find a community independent to run in that seat. But at the end of the day, it is up to communities in each electorate to drive that. You know, for me, it was the Voices of Goldstein. They'd been operating for a year or two. They were looking for someone to run. They sort of interviewed and auditioned about 12 to 15 people, then they sort of came across me and we went through a process until I agreed to run. But it was very much driven by them. Mm. And so it has to come from the bottom up. You know, this is the whole point of the community independence movement, that it has to be driven by community, and community needs to show that there's enough interest in it that the community will get behind it for it to work. So it's kind of like, over to you guys, anyone who's listening, you know, if you want to get a community independent up for the next election, you'd need to be thinking about it now.
Zoe, are you tired of the term teal?
Look, you know, it's marketing you can't buy.
Yeah, it is true.
That's kind of true. Branding. I mean, you know, if you were trying to create that brand, it would cost you, you know, millions of dollars potentially to create it. It's a media term. It's shorthand that the media created. And as far as I'm concerned, that horse is...
Was it ever your colour, though? Were you ever... It actually was?
It was, but the thing is that, you know, people have this thing of, you know, liberal blue and green mixed together makes teal, and that's why. And to be honest, my campaign team and I were like, oh, well, what colour can we have? Because, you know, red, blue, green, yellow, all these colours are already taken. And I'm like, well, my favourite colour is teal, so let's have teal. That is literally what happened.
That's great.
And then it just so happened that later, but the penny sort of dropped for me, that Zali Steggall had used the colour teal, and that was the connotation of the colour. And look, the connotation is not unreasonable. Mm. They're very climate focused, and in my case, socially progressive, economically conservative perspective, and therefore that's fine. But really, either way, I don't think it matters.
Yeah. No.
We're stuck with it.
Zoe Daniel, Jack here, just behind the panel. I've been keeping my head down for most of this interview, but I kind of wanted to ask about the next federal election, which is still a little bit of a ways off. But I mean, yourself and a number of the independents that, from memory, if not were supported by, had some sort of association with Simon Holmes at court, had a lot of a focus, as you mentioned, on climate action. How do you feel that yourself and some of your independent peers on the crossbench, like Zali Steggall, like Monique Ryan here in Melbourne, how do you feel that these independents, and yourself specifically, if you feel like you can only really speak to that, will be assessed going into the next federal election? What do you think is the bar that you will be held to be able to stay in Parliament?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of pieces to that. One is sort of literal KPIs, and anyone who's listening who's in my electorate would have received a newspaper from me in the last week where we have gone through systematically to say, well, this is what you asked me to do, this is what I've done, and talking about some of those gender policies that we've been able to move, putting 43% of the floor not a ceiling in the Climate Change Act and a range of other things. So people can go, okay, well, those things have been done, and then these things are what I'm now trying to push through the pipeline. 75 by 35 as a climate target is something that I'll be adopting going into the next election, as will several other members of the crossbench. So there's that kind of thing. But I think even this morning I was out doing a pop-up office down in Brighton, and several people said to me, you know, politics has changed since you've been there. The level of oversight, the accountability, the keeping the major parties on their toes has changed. That dynamic has shifted. So, you know, that's a slightly more amorphous thing, changing culture, holding the government and the opposition to account, forcing them to be more ambitious, directly reflecting community, calling things out, speaking up on things that they won't because of political risk. You know, they're all of the functions that independents play, as well as those other specific things of changing that legislation, making sure that policy is moved forward, and, you know, forcing the government to be particularly more ambitious on climate, but also resolve a range of other issues around integrity and gender equality and ensuring future prosperity and economic growth and resolving cost of living issues, which is, and housing, which are very fundamental to, I'm sure, many people who are listening.
Zoe, thank you so much. We do have one of our listeners, Mel, regular contributors, says, I saw Zoe at the Global Citizens Conference and she was great. So you have plenty of fans on this on Saturday Magazine. We really appreciate you taking some time out of your Saturday. I believe that your daughter has rowed today or is about to row.
She is rowing. She is rowing in the head of school girls down at Geelong.
Head of the river? Did you? Wow.
Well, we wish her all the best. And you also, Zoe, thank you so much and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.